content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with an article from the March 12, 2025 online edition of the New Yorker, The 2,000-Year-Old Virgins, How Christianity Blurred the Line Between Celibacy and Androgyny, by S.C. Cornell. As far as we know, Jesus never said anything about gay sex. He did, however, take a stand on family life. He was opposed. Those who are worthy of heaven, he says in Luke 20:35, need not bother with marriage. In fact, per Luke 14:26, the true disciple must hate the family he already has. In the Gospel of Matthew, Jesus declares, "Everyone who has left houses or brothers or sisters or father or mother or wife or children or fields for my sake will receive 100 times as much and will inherit eternal life." Christianity's earliest missionaries were also chilly on pair bonding, in part because they believed that at any moment Jesus would return to whisk his followers off to a heavenly reward many times better than sex. With the rapture so near, who had time for a wife and kids? Jesus' failure to return in the first century, what the Oxford historian Diarmaid McCulloch calls the first great disappointment of many in Christian history, did not silence the anti-family tendency in Christian thought. As McCulloch argues in his thrilling and comprehensive new book, Lower Than the Angels, A History of Sex and Christianity, published by Viking, marriage and family have, in historical terms, come only lately into fashion among Christians. It is better to marry than to burn, the Apostle Paul famously wrote, but even better is to douse the flames of lust with an analogous but more elevated communion with God, to partake in what McCulloch calls the substitute families of a celibate religious life. Divorce, though generally forbidden, was allowed if a husband wanted to leave marriage for monkhood. In Western Europe, clergy did not regularly perform weddings until the 12th century, and as late as the 16th century in England, such ceremonies were deemed too lowly to take place in a church's inner sanctum. They might instead be held outside on the porch, after which newlyweds could enter the church to attend Mass. McCulloch points out that this approach is much like the compromise that some churches, including the Anglican and Catholic ones, have struck with gay couples today. McCulloch has more than an academic interest in Christian attitudes toward sex. The son and grandson of priests, he pursued the same role in the Anglican Church until he decided that it was impossible to do so as a gay man. His resulting break with the priesthood was, he told The Guardian last year, a matter of extraordinary stress, trauma, misery. He understands that his critics might see this new book as payback. But McCulloch, who in his second career as an academic has won most of the prizes a historian can win, does not come across as an embittered man. He remains a member of the Anglican Church, per The Guardian. He continues to play the organ on Sundays. He seems to take pleasure less in embarrassing the institution than in sharing the fruits of many decades of study. For much of Christian history, McCulloch suggests, all sex was sinful, even the marital and procreative, even the unconscious. As the Anglican theologian Adrian Thatcher writes in Vile Bodies, The Body in Christian Teaching, Faith, and Practice, quote, "It is difficult to believe the agony and consternation caused to perfection-seeking monks by wet dreams over the centuries," end quote. Religious leaders specified days on which, for medical or liturgical reasons, married couples were not to copulate. One Irish rulebook from the early 7th century excluded a good two-thirds of the year. Russian Orthodox guides for confessors grouped excessive marital sex with sins, such as anal intercourse or prostitution. St. Jerome, a tremendously influential 4th century commentator known for his Latin translation of the Bible, liked to remind people that, quote, every man who is sexually unrestrained in his interaction with his wife commits adultery with her, end quote. Some Christians, including several notable saints, sought to escape sin entirely through celibate marriages, which, per McCulloch, were esteemed and practiced for more than a millennium. These early Christians' opposition to procreation, their nose-thumbing at what has always been the easiest way of spreading a religion, is without question a revolutionary and anti-materialistic stance. And yet, it is a good example that what is revolutionary and anti-materialistic is not necessarily conducive to human happiness. If you were a Christian and your spouse died young, as people often did in the 4th century, you might be forbidden sex or parenthood for the rest of your life. The controversy around a widow's remarriage stemmed partly from a theological analogy in which a woman was meant to serve one husband as the church served one God. Under such logic, a second marriage seemed almost polytheistic. But another factor was simply a visceral disgust of sex and family life. McCulloch quotes a letter from the same Jerome in which he urges a young widow in his circle not to remarry. You have already learned the miseries of marriage. It's like unwholesome food. And now that you have relieved your heaving stomach of its bile, why should you return to it again, like a dog to its vomit? Perhaps you are afraid that your noble race will die out, and your father will not have a brat to crawl about his shoulders and smear his neck with filth. McCulloch is particularly engaging in his discussion of how baffling the early Christian mortification of the flesh would have seemed to contemporaries. Greco-Roman tradition had long idealized the vigorous, penetrating patriarch, and Jewish custom celebrated those men who had large families and multiple wives. Reversing this hierarchy, Christians held that status among men increased with greater remove from sex. The laity were to be monogamous, the holy men celibate, and the actually divine would not even feel lust. In the Bible, angels have been portrayed as the seducers of mortal women, much like Greek gods. Once heaven was seen as a place without sex, they were deemed too lofty for such concerns. Saint Augustine argued that Jesus did not have erections. Another theologian noted that if true, this would make the Son of God functionally a eunuch. The line between celibacy and androgyny, between not having sex and not having a sex, can blur. Some translators assume that Jesus' admiring reference to eunuchs who have made themselves for the sake of the kingdom of heaven actually alludes to the celibate and glossed the phrase as those who choose to live like eunuchs, or even those who choose not to marry. This downplays the social position of actual eunuchs, who sometimes rose to high-ranking positions in the church. As McCulloch writes, impoverished parents might arrange for their son to be castrated to better his prospects for religious life and education. Even men who kept the machinery of sex and simply chose not to use it could be feminized. Nuns today are still sometimes spoken of as the brides of Christ. Before the church was sensitive to gay innuendo, the institution itself, and by implication its male leaders, were too. A 3rd century bishop drew the analogy further when he wrote flatteringly of the Apostle Paul that he had received, quote, into his womb the seeds of life, end quote. The horny angels of the Bible have been depicted with beards or even bald spots. By the end of the 4th century, they transformed into the ruby-cheeked pretty boys we know today. Origen, a prominent 3rd century commentator, controversially argued that humans in heaven would undergo a similar transformation. that anyone who made it to a lustless afterlife would lose their sexual differentiation. Of course, then as now, not everyone waited for the afterlife. In the apocryphal Gospel of Thomas, Jesus says that every woman who makes herself male will enter the kingdom of heaven. In other words, by distancing themselves from the physicality and sex long associated with women, female ascetics and nuns approach something like manhood. Elise, from around 400 AD, refers to two ascetics as female renouncers. Amasera, a 5th century hermit in what is now Egypt, is quoted as saying, "According to nature, I am a woman, but not according to my thoughts." A hagiography written by a man about his cloistered virgin sister hesitates to insult her with the title of woman, given that she is above nature. These days, Christians often employ the word unnatural to argue that something is morally wrong. In the morality of early Christians, however, nature was exactly what needed to be outrun. A 2nd century document known as the Proto-Evangelium of James sought to save Mary from any taint of nature's pollution. It introduced the idea that Mary had remained a virgin until death, even after giving birth to Jesus, not to mention after the conception and birth of his theologically inconvenient siblings. Some Catholics today hold that the references to Jesus' siblings in Scripture refer to Joseph's children from a previous marriage. The Proto-Evangelium further claim that Mary herself had been divinely conceived. Several centuries later, this idea would be retrofitted to spare Mary from Augustine's concept of the original sin that stains all the descendants of the sexually active Adam and Eve. The Christmas carol, "O Come, All Ye Faithful," claims that God abhors not the virgin's womb, as opposed, presumably, to his abhorrence of the other ones. I had heard "O Come, All Ye Faithful" many times, but had never noticed this line until I read about it in Helen King's lively Immaculate Forms, A History of the Female Body in 4 Parts, published by Basic. King is a British classicist interested in the many ways that women's bodies have been misunderstood by the Western world, including the damage done by Christianity. She and McCulloch are friendly. King was an early reader for his manuscript, and they share a connection to the Anglican Church. King is currently an elected member of its synod and a vice chair of an Anglican anti-discrimination group. But where McCulloch retains a certain reverence toward what for him remains the capital C church, King's tone is cheeky throughout. They each take, for example, a different approach to the cult interpretation of Christ's side wound as a type of vulva. McCulloch dismisses this as cringe-making, while King dives right in. Her main critique of Lower Than the Angels, McCulloch told an interviewer, is that he didn't mention the clitoris enough. King's book does not suffer from the same deficit. Immaculate Forms is organized not by time period, but by body part: breast, clitoris, hymen, and womb, a choice that makes the book less a sustained argument in support of a certain kind of femaleness than a compendium of trivia ranging from Eve to Mary, from ancient Roman wet nurses to Victorian clitorectomy clinics. But the variety and contradiction of the trivia provides its own kind of argument. "The story I will tell," King writes, "is not a reassuring narrative of progress, but one with no clear direction, no steady logical development toward a now in which we know pretty much all there is to know." Her book leaves you with the impression that, no matter what you believe to be obvious and natural about the female body, somebody in power once believed the exact opposite. In the West, virginity, orgasms, and clitorectomies have been deemed both healthy and unhealthy for women, who have been imagined as both hornier and less horny than men. The bodies of men and women have been entirely different, or fundamentally the same, but simply cooked for different amounts of time, such that a woman might heat up and spontaneously turn male. There may be some truth to this. Today we understand children who unexpectedly go through male puberty to have a condition called 5-alpha reductase deficiency. Ting's examples are almost dizzying in their zaniness. Which is more natural, she asks, to have puppies suckle at your breast to take off excess milk, or to make breast milk into ice cream? In her discussion of Christianity, King relishes the absurdity that results when a religion that is disgusted by female sexuality also engages in mother worship. Some medieval and Renaissance artists, for example, portrayed Mary breastfeeding the infant Jesus at a chaste distance, such that the milk spurts of its own accord into his mouth. Depictions of the Annunciation, when the angel Gabriel came to Mary to tell her that she would give birth to Jesus, struggled to portray just how the Word of God entered her body. They knew it wasn't through the vagina, the so-called gates of hell, but they couldn't agree on an alternate orifice. The ear? The mouth? King explains that for much of Christian history, menstruating women were not allowed into religious spaces. At some modern-day Coptic Orthodox churches, they are still forbidden from taking communion. Would the virginal, and so presumably menstruating Mary, have been barred from worshiping her son? Such tremendous disgust for the female body was no Christian innovation. The Hebrew Bible's book of Leviticus claims that anyone who even touches a seat on which a menstruating woman has sat is unclean for the rest of the day. But it is hard to square with all the talk of the blessed fruit of her womb. It is easy to forget that Christianity spent its first centuries in relative obscurity. The sexual mores of Jesus and his followers might today have the same curio value as, say, Manichaean vegetarianism or Zoroastrian incest. One reason they do not is because of a battle at a bridge in Rome in the year 312 that took place between Constantine and Maxentius, two aspirants to the throne of the Roman Empire. Before fighting, Constantine ordered his soldiers to pray to the Christian God. What happened next was world historical. Maxentius drowned in the river, and the triumphant Constantine began to spread Christianity through his territories. On any rational political calculation, McCulloch writes, this would seem bizarre. Christianity was simply not that important in the empire, and Christians would have been delighted merely not to be persecuted. Over the next centuries, as Christendom spread east through Asia and north and west through Europe, its ambitions grew along with the institutional hierarchy needed to implement them. The bishops of Rome relied on a set of 8th-century forged documents to claim an unprecedented position of universal authority as popes. Exposure to new polygamous cultures prompted the church to view marriage, for the first time, as something it should trouble itself with regulating. Even as the church at large continued to keep weddings out of churches, Eastern Orthodox leaders codified the Christian ideal of monogamy. Competition with Islam led Christians to adjust their views on pacifism and procreation. By the 12th century, violence against Muslims was holy, and the production of children to aid in the fight was, for those not required to be celibate, a Christian duty. In a reversal, theologians now argued that, actually, Adam and Eve had enjoyed sex. The imperialist Christians, decidedly worldly reasons to support marriage and procreation, did not do away with the idealization of celibacy, so much as shift its accounting. The sex allowance for married people to reproduce would be offset by stricter celibacy from the servants of God. As late as the 10th century, a majority of priests were married. Nuns were occasionally married to monks, and some bishops and popes had children, whom they might marry off advantageously. Now, a desire to hold on to church lands, which clergy could bequeath to their legitimate sons, led to a crackdown on clerical marriage. The backlash would eventually provoke, in part, both the schism between the Latin West and the Greek East and the Protestant Reformation. Catholics viewed the upstart Protestants as loosey-goosey on matters of sex. Martin Luther had even flirted with accepting polygamy. In 1563, a papal council doubled down. Anyone who proclaimed that, quote, it is better and happier to be united in matrimony than to remain in virginity or celibacy, end quote, was to be excommunicated for heresy. The emphasis on the procreative possibility of sex gave rise to a new respect for nature and a new understanding of non-reproductive sex acts as sins against it. The relative seriousness of these sins can be gleaned from their associated punishments. One Irish penitential called for a year's penance for bestiality, 4 years for oral sex, and 7 years for sodomy. With the purity of the clergy a matter of ever-growing importance, church leaders zeroed in on the types of sins that men in cloistered single-sex environments could more feasibly commit. Peter Damian, a prominent 11th century cardinal who did much to popularize homophobia in the church, preached that a father who has sex with his daughter was less sinful than a bishop who has sex with a priest he has ordained, because while the father has sinned merely against a biological child, the bishop has sinned against a spiritual one. By 1120, the church council in Jerusalem ordered that sodomites, like heretics, be burned at the stake. Later laws against homosexuality sometimes came about for petty or arbitrary reasons. A 1534 law that outlawed buggery on pain of death may very well have been an effort by King Henry VIII to bully the church, even then widely considered a den of buggers, into accepting his marriage to Anne Boleyn. Several centuries later, an 1885 English law against gross indecency was proposed and passed by men who had, for the most part, spent their youth at the country's famously gay boarding schools. The statute was then copied in penal codes throughout the British Empire. It further spread through soft power. Just as earlier Muslim territorial gains had led some Christians to wonder if they shouldn't adopt the Islamic prohibition of icons, British imperial successes inspired Muslims to crack down on sodomy, which they had shown little interest in punishing until the 20th century. Such, McCulloch writes, were some unanticipated outcomes from the playing fields of Eton. The celibate ideal, a constant throughout Catholic history, has found new expression in the modern divide between straight people who may copulate without sin in marriage and gay people who can avoid sin only through lifelong chastity. A 1975 declaration known as the Persona Humana set out what largely remains the Catholic attitude today, that homosexual acts are intrinsically disordered, a phrase that also applies to masturbation, but that homosexuals who just can't help themselves must certainly be treated with understanding and sustained in the hope of overcoming their personal difficulties and their inability to fit into society. In practice, overcoming their personal difficulties can mean conversion therapy. The church believes that God made certain people pathologically and possibly incurably gay, but in true Christ-like fashion, it never gives up on a hopeless case. Since Pope Francis's ascendancy, the Catholic Church's attitude toward gay and trans people has become slightly less harsh and slightly more confusing. Many people will remember that in 2013, Pope Francis said, "Who am I to judge?" in response to a question about homosexuality. Perhaps fewer remember that the question, according to a biographer of Francis's, was in reference to a Vatican priest who looked after the papal house and who had been found trapped in the elevator of the nunciature with a gay rent boy known to the police. Francis seems unsure how to address homosexuality among his colleagues. He has both denied that there are any members of the feared gay lobby in the Vatican and complained about the high levels of faggotry in seminaries, a comment for which he later apologized. And for all the progress Francis has made in welcoming all of God's children, including meeting with several groups of trans Catholics, he also oversaw last year's Dignitas Infinita, which proclaimed that, quote, any sex change intervention, as a rule, risks threatening the unique dignity the person has received from the moment of conception, end quote. This year, a conference of Italian bishops ruled that openly gay men can join orders as long as they maintain the celibacy expected of all priests, a decision that normalized what has long been a quiet reality for many priests and nuns. A 2020 book called Love Tenderly, Sacred Stories of Lesbian and Queer Religious, includes the stories of 23 sisters from around the United States, many of whom have been out and mostly celibate for decades. The book makes clear that a vow of celibacy can be liberating both as an alternative to heterosexuality, one nun calls the idea of sex with a man grotesque, and as a radical and, as several nuns claim, queer, alternative to the exclusivity and selfishness of pair bonding. But the dilemma posed to the lesbian who must choose between the woman she loves and the God she loves is described by nuns again and again in terms of the greatest pain and difficulty. The vow of celibacy strikes me as a sort of self-imposed conversion therapy, an effort to sexually reorient oneself toward what one nun calls a relationship with someone whom I can neither see nor touch. As I read these nun stories, I was reminded of a young woman named Elena Chen, who, like me, used to attend St. Thomas Aquinas, a small Catholic church in Boulder, Colorado. When Elena was 14, she confessed to a priest that she was attracted to girls and spent the next few years being counseled by him and others in the church in the hopes of becoming a nun. "He forgave my unspeakable sin," she wrote in her diary. "He took my defilement and buried it." In 2019, when Elena was 23, she gave an interview to the Denver Post about her many years undergoing what she now viewed as conversion therapy. "I felt like the church and the counseling was the thing that was saving me," she said. "The worse I got, the more I clung to it." 4 months later, Elena's body was found at a local reservoir. Amid the uproar, a spokesperson for the Archdiocese of Denver gave a statement to the press. "A person is always free to accept or reject what the church teaches," he said. "But it is not conversion therapy or religious abuse to teach about the beauty of a life of chastity." Next, I'll read to you the weekend essay from the April 19, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Mistaking Mary Magdalene. The subject of numerous controversies, she is defined by ambiguity, welcoming outcasts to the church and provoking more imaginative approaches to faith. By Eliza Griswold. An ancient depiction of a naked woman hung on the wall of my father's study. Skeletal, stupefied, and wildly beheaded, she contemplated distances across time and space, as saints and mystics do. As with many of the unsettling religious tchotchkes scattered around the rectory where I spent my childhood, I didn't give much thought to the unkept icon, until more recently, when I grew curious about Mary Magdalene and began to read into the controversies surrounding her. Magdalene is the most famous woman in Christianity after Jesus' mother. She is also arguably the most hotly contested figure in the New Testament. A companion to Jesus in all four Gospels, she is present at his tomb and, in some versions, is the first to see him after his resurrection. In the book of John, Jesus commissions her to share the good news of his return with the other disciples, which is why Thomas Aquinas, the 13th century theologian, names her the Apostle to the Apostles. Nonetheless, Magdalene has been maligned by church fathers throughout the centuries. In the present day, feminist scholars have championed her. Magdalene, appearing in Scripture only 14 times, belongs to a tangle of at least six women named Mary. This multitude of Marys leaves considerable room for disagreement over which biblical threads are authentically woven into Magdalene's story, and which aren't. In the Eastern Orthodox Church, she has a long and unassailed history of veneration. In the West, she's been sanctified, but also portrayed as a sinner, a nun, a mystic, and Jesus' wife. She remains, above all, a liminal figure. The patron saint of outcasts, she embodies uncertainty. There are so many disparate stories, Elaine Pagels, the renowned religious scholar, told me on the sun porch of her home in Princeton, New Jersey. To underscore the point, Pagels went to fetch a copy of the New Oxford Annotated Bible, flipping between the books of Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, and pausing over discrepancies between their Magdalene narratives. The writers of the New Testament didn't seem much interested in women, except in their subsidiary roles, she said. She poked around in the book of Luke to show me how the author diminished Mary Magdalene's significance. She's present at the resurrection, but only among other women. Instead of encountering the risen Lord, these women see two angels. Luke deprecates her role, Pagels said. Pagels' expertise, however, stretches far beyond the four Gospels that, by the start of the 5th century, had become the official canon. She has explored a much larger body of texts, many of which include women in more authoritative roles. Consider, she suggested, the Gospel of Philip, a 3rd century text discovered with similar documents near Nag Hammadi in Egypt in 1945, in which Magdalene is described as the woman who always walked with the Lord and the one who was called his companion. In its telling, her expansive influence transcends the terrestrial. As Pagels put it, she's seen as a manifestation of divine wisdom. Along with icons of anorexic saints, my childhood home was a place of books. Pagels' The Gnostic Gospels shared a shelf with the complete poems of Emily Dickinson and Carl Jung's Memories, Dreams, Reflections. Each in its own way invited a friendly skepticism of orthodoxy and imbued value in people and ideas previously relegated to the edge. As Dickinson writes, tell all the truth, but tell it slant. Mary Magdalene is a cipher for slantwise truth. To engage with her story requires divine imagination. Beyond the scant scriptural references, a rich treasury of myth can be found. My favorite, a 13th century French narrative known as the Golden Legend, features Magdalene and Jesus' friend Lazarus, who, in this and some other accounts, is said to be her brother. With a handful of followers, the two board a boat 14 years after Jesus' crucifixion and land on the southern coast of France. There, Magdalene lives and teaches until her death. Two dueling French monasteries still claim to hold her relics. On July 22nd, her feast day, they venerate her as their patron saint. Magdalene is rendered more complex by associations with sexual desire. In the popular imagination, she's a repentant prostitute. Yet, as I read more about who Mary Magdalene was, I was startled to learn that nothing in the New Testament associates her with licentiousness. Instead, this claim originated in a series of sermons given by Pope Gregory in the year 591. Gregory argued that Magdalene should be understood as highly sinful, referring to a story in the book of Luke in which Jesus exorcised 7 demons from her body. Feminist scholars have questioned this interpretation, raising the possibility that Magdalene's 7 demons reflect the Eastern concept of 7 chakras rather than a sinful nature. Maybe Jesus was clearing Magdalene's chakras. Pope Gregory, believing these demons to be an indication of Magdalena's excessive sinful past, he identified her as an unnamed woman in Luke who wiped Jesus' feet with her hair. Each of the four canonical Gospels recounts a version of this story, of a woman who, much to the frustration of the disciples, empties an expensive alabaster jar of unguent in order to anoint Jesus before he dies. In Matthew, Mark, and John, the disciples complained to Jesus that the costly perfume, which was called nard and derived from a kind of honeysuckle, could have been sold to raise money to feed the poor. Pope Gregory emphasized the nard as proof that Magdalena was a prostitute, claiming that the expensive perfume masked the stink of the sex trade. Gregory, who became known as Gregory the Great, had reasons to advance such an argument. A reforming figure who led the church during a time of plague, Gregory was an aristocrat who had renounced his wealth and become celibate. Women were linked to sin through carnal desire. As James Carroll, the author of Constantine's Sword and a former Catholic priest, has noted, the key to understanding these sermons is understanding Gregory's intended audience, which was male. Gregory calls his listeners brothers. In identifying Magdalena as the unnamed woman, Gregory succeeded in helping to marginalize women in the church for the next 1,400 years. In 1969, the Catholic Church went so far as to apologize for advancing this claim, but the power of the association was so strong that many people still hold the mistaken belief that Magdalena was a prostitute. I'm slightly embarrassed to say that I was one of them, until several years ago, when I began reading about Magdalena and learned what Pope Gregory had done. Disgusted by history and dismayed by my own ignorance, I went to chat with my father, a retired Episcopal bishop and a student of early Christian tradition. At the time, he was also my neighbor, and I found him at the kitchen table eating his breakfast of steel-cut oats. There was more to contending with the myth of Magdalena than dispelling Pope Gregory's assertion, he told me. This was also an ancient case of mistaken identity. Disappearing from the table, my father returned with that eerie icon of the naked woman. Her name, he explained, was Mary of Egypt, and she was, tradition holds, a 5th-century street prostitute. My dad revered Mary of Egypt, who was also known as the harlot of the desert and was largely forgotten in the West. He'd come to know of her while traveling to monasteries in the Jordan Valley, and he proposed that we take a trip to one of them, called St. Gerasimos, together. This was the spring of 2020, however, and the impossibilities of international travel and my dad's frail health delayed the journey. I kept delving into Mary of Egypt. Curiously enough, a scholar and a friend of mine, Amy Fraucombe, had recently written a book about her, Wild Woman, A Footnote, The Desert and My Quest for an Elusive Saint, in which Fraucombe translates from the Greek a 7th-century chronicle of Mary's life. The scribe writes about Mary of Egypt, living in doorways in the city of Alexandria for 17 years, until one day, she spies several young men who are vigorous in their bodies and their movements, running to board a ship. She asks who they might be and discovers that they are Christian pilgrims on their way to Jerusalem. Over the phone, Fraucombe read aloud to me some of the passages that she had translated. "I am going to go up into one of those boats they have hired, and they will take care of me, even if they don't want to," the scribe reports Mary saying, "for I have this body that they will receive instead of passage." The sexually explicit nature of the text startled me and provoked a laugh. After paying for her passage and sexual favors, Mary of Egypt arrived in Jerusalem. Yet, when she attempted to accompany the pilgrims inside the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, which sits on the storied site of Jesus' crucifixion and burial, she found herself barred from entering the church by a mysterious force. She pushes and she shoves and she tries to get in, but she can't, Fraucombe said. Then, Mary of Egypt heard a voice calling her to cross the river Jordan into the desert. There she lived as a hermit. Her clothes fell to shreds, her flesh wasted away. Eventually, only her long locks covered her body as, for 47 years, she prayed. Tradition has her an icon of repentance, but to me it's much more interesting to view her as an icon of desire, Prycombe said. For her, one desire leads to another desire, and this leads then her to God. Finally, in the desert, a monk named Zosimus encountered her. Zosimus, in the throes of a spiritual crisis, was seeking a wise man to give him counsel. He met Mary of Egypt instead. The great moment of the story is he's going in search of a desert father and finds a mother, Prycombe said. No one knows for sure what monastery Zosimus came from, but the monks of St. Gerasimos, which lies a few miles away, claim him as a spiritual father. This was why my father wanted to take me to St. Gerasimos, so that I could hear the story of Zosimus and Mary of Egypt directly from the monks. We never made it. My dad's health continued to falter, and when he died 2 years ago, I stopped sleuthing among the Marys. It had principally been a way to play with my dad, who found humor in the human errors that are rife in supposed matters of biblical certainty. Divine truth can as easily be revealed through myth and poetry as it can be through literal truth, my dad liked to say, paraphrasing Charles Gore, a bishop of Oxford. Before my father died, he pointed out one more error by which Mary Magdalene had become entwined with Mary of Egypt. It began with the ancient naked icon. During the course of centuries, this image of a shriven prostitute became conflated with Magdalena. In approximately 1455, the Italian master Donatello carved a wooden figure called the Penitent Magdalene, emaciated, barefooted, and dressed in what looks like feathers but is, in fact, hair. In 1460, Antonio del Pollaiuolo followed suit, painting Magdalena ascending to heaven as a kind of human sheepdog with well-muscled arms. Around the year 1565, the Venetian Renaissance painter Titian updated the Penitent Magdalene, representing her as a zaftid figure with milky skin, her eyes still cast skyward in prayer, corkscrew curls cascading into delicatage. A decade later, El Greco depicted his Penitent Magdalena with a nipple peeking out. This visual narrative of Magdalena as a half-naked woman in prayerful penance continues through Caravaggio's sexy and ambiguous Mary Magdalene in Ecstasy from 1606, and Rubens' tableau Christ and Penitent Sinners, in which a foregrounded Magdalena, wound in tresses of her hair, kneels at Jesus' feet. In December 2024, the Italian art restorer and researcher Sarah Pinco discovered a figure she argues is Mary Magdalene on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. In Michelangelo's version, Magdalena's golden hair flows over her shoulders, exposing a bony clavicle as she leans forward to kiss the cross. The most intriguing elements of Magdalena's story remain the most mysterious. Among them is a gospel written in her name, first discovered in a Cairo bazaar in the late 1800s. Although, like so many biblical narratives, the Gospel of Mary was excluded from the canon, scholars contend that the text was in wide circulation among Jesus' early followers. What I love most about the Gospel of Mary is how it ends with an argument. After Jesus' death, Mary Magdalena comes to his disciples to tell them that he has given her secret teachings. But Andrew and Peter question whether Jesus would really have done such a thing. How is it possible that the teacher talked in this manner with a woman about secrets of which we ourselves are ignorant? Peter asks. Must we change our customs and listen to this woman? Did he really choose her and prefer her to us? On close reading, this is funny. Peter isn't just questioning her. He's complaining about how much work the disciples will be required to do if they have to change their practices based on these new teachings. In response, Magdalena begins to cry. The Coptic gives us Mary wept. The sentence mirrors the moment that Jesus wept when he found out that Lazarus had died. Her tears seem to soften the disciples, who listen as Mary Magdalene begins to lay out the teachings. She recounts asking Jesus how to reach God, through the psyche or the spirit. Neither, Jesus tells her. God speaks to us through what Jesus calls the new, which is often translated from the Greek as mind, but it is perhaps more accurately thought of as consciousness. This alternative vision of Mary Magdalene as a companion to Jesus and as a spiritual teacher lends itself to modern interpretation. One summer evening, I joined Megan Watterson, a Magdalene scholar who holds a degree from the Harvard Divinity School. The author of the book, Mary Magdalene Revealed, Watterson was at the Meditation Gym in Brooklyn, MNDFL, to offer the ancient instructions of Mary's secret gospel. Beyond an airy entry hall, where the gym sold turmeric tea and pricey strands of prayer beads, about 30 women leaned against black blackjacks or sat upright on meditation cushions. Watterson, with her chin dropped to her chest, directed the group to glance into their hearts to search for the new, much as she believed the ancient group of Christians called the Hesychast did. The practice allowed the meditators to view their devotion as closely tied to Magdalene. I'm always intrigued by how people identify with biblical characters, whether it's Jesus' mother or Mary Magdalene, Pagels told me. It's an intimate relationship. They become like family members. Authenticity, however, like certainty, can be a trap. For serious scholars, cautionary tales surrounding claims of Mary Magdalene abound. None is more painful than that of Karen L. King, the Hollis Professor of Divinity at Harvard Divinity School, who, in 2012, held a press conference near the Vatican to announce the discovery of an ancient papyrus fragment. The fragment, which she called the Gospel of Jesus' Wife, substantiated her theory that Mary Magdalene may have been Jesus' confidant and disciple. The papyrus scrap contained only 14 lines. Many were broken. It read, Jesus said to them, my wife, dot, dot, dot. It went on, she is able to be my disciple. King argued that there seemed to be enough evidence to suggest that Jesus was speaking of Mary Magdalene and probably defending her authority to a group of men. In 2016, a journalist named Ariel Sabar revealed that the fragment was almost certainly a fake, crafted perhaps to draw in King specifically because her hypothesis about Magdalene's role in Jesus' life was well known. After reading Sabar's investigation, King acknowledged that it tips the balance towards forgery. More recently, after publishing part of her master's thesis in the Harvard Theological Review, a relatively new Magdalena scholar, Elizabeth Schrader Pulitzer, has garnered significant attention. Based on her reading of Papyrus 66, thought to be the world's oldest complete copy of the Gospel of John and other crucial manuscripts, Schrader Pulitzer, an assistant professor of New Testament at Villanova University, argues that a second century scribe deliberately suppressed the role of Mary Magdalene. A textual analysis of John 11 and 12, in which Jesus travels to the city of Bethany to visit Lazarus's family shortly after his friend's death, reveals, quote, some very strange scribal activity, end quote. Her scholarship has helped decipher some largely forgotten clues in the ancient papyrus, discovered in Egypt in the early 1950s, about why a woman's name has been crossed out and her character split in two. Schrader Pulitzer followed an unlikely path to become a biblical scholar. A former singer-songwriter from Portland, Oregon, she won the first Pantene Pro Voice competition in 2001, several months after graduating from Pomona College. That summer, as part of the prize, Schrader Pulitzer, who went by the name Libby Schrader, opened for the pop star Jewel on stage in New York City's Central Park, performing a song called Blood Red Moon. It was about a late period, Schrader Pulitzer told me. She moved to Brooklyn and spent the next decade trying to break through in the music business. She had some successes. She appeared on an episode of Gilmore Girls, but mostly supported herself by teaching piano and playing college gigs. Facing a professional crossroads, Schrader Pulitzer, who'd been baptized in the Episcopal Church, walked through the wrought iron gates of the co-cathedral of St. Joseph in Prospect Heights. There, she prayed in the garden, surrounded by disintegrating statues of Jesus' mother. Asking for direction, she heard a clear, if surprising, response. Maybe you should talk to Mary Magdalene about that. In 2011, she began working on an album called Magdalena. In a music video for the title track, Schrader Pulitzer, wearing jeans and a white crocheted top, returns to the cathedral churchyard, quote, to ask for the blessing of the Magdalena, as her title song instructs. She sings this. She's a bleeding heart full of blinding light, which she carefully conceals till the time is right. Oh, a woman heavy with the dark of night. She will do, alleluia, what she came here to do. She is ready now to do what she came to do. The writing of the song came quickly and easily, but Schrader Pulitzer wanted to ground her enthusiasm in historical context. I can't make a record called Magdalena and not really know anything about Mary Magdalene, she said. So Schrader Pulitzer went to the Brooklyn Public Library and checked out The Complete Idiot's Guide to Mary Magdalena by Lisa Bellevue. It's actually really good, she told me. The book laid out, in scholarly detail, competing narratives about who Mary Magdalena was. One of the most heated debates centered on whether Mary Magdalena is indeed the same Mary who is the sister of Lazarus, a figure scholars often refer to as Mary of Bethany. This matters because if Mary Magdalena and Mary of Bethany are the same person, then Magdalena's role in Scripture grows more significant. She is the woman who anoints Jesus in John. To consider this question and others, Schrader Pulitzer wanted to return to the world's oldest surviving copy of John to see exactly how the first anonymous scribes set down the story. Yet, when Schrader Pulitzer first pulled up the transcription of Papyrus 66 on her computer screen, she realized that it was in Greek, which she didn't yet read. So she set about going through the text line by line with an interlinear study Bible. As she examined the Greek character, she noticed that the anonymous scribe had made a series of changes. Quote, there are 450 corrections throughout the manuscript, end quote, she said. One set of alterations caught Schrader Pulitzer's attention. In the story of Jesus raising Lazarus from the dead, she could see that the scribe had changed a woman's name. In a crucial passage, the name Mary had been altered to Martha by crossing out the Greek letter I, iota, and replacing it with a th, theta. In other places, the verb agreements had also been changed from singular to plural, indicating that one named woman had been split into two unnamed women, called the sisters. It looked like Martha was getting added to the story, Schrader Pulitzer said. To my total uneducated eye, it looked like an editor might be trying to dilute the role of Lazarus's sister, Mary. Schrader Pulitzer returned to school and earned a Ph.D. in Early Christianity and New Testament from Duke University. She made other discoveries, which contributed to her sense that Mary Magdalene had been diluted in the Gospel of John. There was her name, Magdalene, which many scholars took as a reference to a fishing village on the Sea of Galilee. Nobody said she came from a place called Magdala until the 6th century, she said. More likely, she is surmised, Magdala was a reference to the Aramaic word for tower, as in Mary Magdalene was a tower in the church, much as the Apostle Peter is referred to as the rock. The figure of Peter has become a cipher for orthodoxy, she said. Mary Magdalena, more of a cipher for direct visionary experience. Over time, Church fathers apparently favored Peter's influence in the early text at the expense of Mary Magdalene. Jesus, before raising Lazarus from the dead, famously declares to Lazarus' sister, Martha, in the edited text, quote, I am the resurrection and the life. Those who believe in me, even though they die, will live. And everyone who lives and believes in me will never die. Do you believe this? Yes, Lord, the sister replies. I believe that you are the Messiah, the Son of God, the one coming into the world. This declaration, called a Christological confession, signifies one of the rare moments in the Bible when a follower of Jesus recognizes who he truly is. When a woman, who some scholars suspect is Mary Magdalene, is erased from this passage in John 11, her role is significantly diminished. It is Peter, the first apostle to recognize Jesus, who comes to the fore in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, and whose name is passed down throughout history. Schrader-Pulitzer's claims, however, go beyond those of a historian. Mary Magdalene's more central role in this gospel, she intuits, has been hidden for a reason. If she'd been too strong a figure and challenged the dominant narrative of Peter, then the book of John may have been left out of the Bible and dismissed as heretical. Maybe this made John suitable for the canon, she said. Magdalene, as Schrader-Pulitzer sees it, is sacrificed in scripture and in history, erased so that she can now be revealed. It's not just Lazarus who is ill, she told me. There's an illness in the text. She perceived the likely change of Magdalene as a wounding of the text itself. And Magdalena's willingness to allow herself to be erased as an example of Jesus' famous invitation to his followers to lay down their lives for their friends. The revelations she has uncovered have also had profound spiritual relevance in her life. Doing this work has deepened my faith, she told me. The Gospel of John is known as the Gospel of Signs, and I think it might have one more sign for us. We've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it. You'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.